Well, Lake Macquarie surprises everybody. They think that it's a small lake until they come and sail around it or go around it by boat. Of course, we've got, I think, over 200 mile of foreshore, and it's all deep water. There's very little shallow water in it. It's a terrific lake as far as deep water goes because we've got maxi yachts sailing on it, and we've got hundreds of yachts sailing on it. The same as cruisers, we've got stacks of cruisers as well.
Charles Hollis commenting on boating on Lake Macquarie. Harry Bond takes us back to his first experience of boating.
My first interest started when I bought the wreck of a yacht that had been wrecked at Newcastle Beach. One yacht returning to Sydney during an ocean race from the Lake Macquarie Yacht Club. They were struck with a southerly gale outside the heads, and this boat landed up on what was known as Big Ben Reef, just below Nobby's. The next day, with a storm, the keel came adrift from the rest of the hull, and permitted the hull to half submerge to rise, go out to sea and turn with the tide and come straight up Newcastle Harbour. I contacted the owner in Sydney who had been rescued from the Birribee and arranged to purchase the salvage. With the aid of a couple of the lads who worked with me, we pulled it up the shoreline at Wickham, and we repaired all the planks and put a new mast in and cast a new lead keel. And believe me, that was my first experience of boat building.
What about some of the boat builders?
Well, there were two very prominent families, the Steels and the Fennells. And there was great competition between the two builders as to who would win the principal races during the year. And those families, at least Fennell, is still building boats. And they won many prizes in lots of places.
Barbara Langwall commenting. She recalls the early sailing competitions.
Well, each place, Toronto, Belmont and Spears Point, had an annual regatta. And all the boats used to congregate in the place. One was on New Year's Day, another was on Anniversary Day. And I've forgotten what the third one was for. But there's great competition between the three places to get the best boat and win the most races.
And who was a frequent winner?
Well, both Steele and Fennell did very well with their boats. There was one named Caress, I remember, that won, I think, the Lake Macquarie Championship. And Fennell also had many wins to his credit.
Well, some people say the love of water is born into you, and in Ruby Osborne's case, that certainly is true. Just ask her why she loves the water so much.
Well, see, my grandfather had the ketch here years ago first. Well, then my brother started building the boats and walls in. We had a big shed in there, and then continued out here. That's when he built all these yachts. All the sailing boys know him, you know. A lot of them have boats that he built.
And, of course, he had some winners there, didn't he?
Four winners of the Hobart race, yes.
That's quite a feat. I wonder if anyone else has equaled that.
I don't think. No, they wouldn't, no.
And you sailed on some of the yachts?
No, not on the yachts. I used to sail with the boys, Ladies' Day, in the 16s, from Toronto Club, but I always sailed at weekends with my father in the 18, and we used to go down to Toronto, this is later, you see, in the my 20s, and we'd follow the race around to see who was winning, and then we'd come home. I remember once we were just sitting there looking towards Spears Point, and a big southerly buster came behind us. We didn't see it. Broke our big mast and missed me by inches. There's only three of us in the boat.
Ruby Osborne. Harry Bond was commodore of one of our clubs.
I was the commodore at one particular time of the Lake Macquarie Yacht Club, and with a boat called Wings, I was the scratch boat for 10 years and won the grand champion 5 times with that particular boat. Lots of the names I can remember from the early days of Lake Macquarie Yacht Club would be Vic Toll and Theo Tyson, Benny Morgan, or a host of others who all had yachts in those days. My activities have all been on Lake Macquarie and mostly with the Lake Macquarie Yacht Club. I have raced from Sydney here in the ocean race, but most of my activities have always been on the lake.
How strict is a yacht race? You have to go to certain marks, certain points, and I suppose error is very easy.
Well, yes, it's there's a lot left to the elements, of course. A lot is up to the decision of the skipper. He can make mistakes, and he can make a wrong forecast of the weather. That's quite simple to make a mistake.
How fast is decision-making got to be?
Well, if you made the wrong decision to put up the wrong sail, we'll say you put up a genoa instead of a jib, that could be 2 or 3 minutes difference, and that 2 or 3 minutes could be quite sufficient to win or lose a race.
And, of course, speedboat racing.
Well, that was with the Royal Motor Yacht Club at Toronto. My first hydroplane, they call them hydroplanes because the hulls had a step in. They were much faster, but they were much more dangerous. The first boat I had was called Bondi. I later took a partner with me, the local doctor, Clary Mitchell, and we called the second boat the Bondoc, which we had a Buick car engine in. And we later acquired another, which we called Wings. And I converted an Espana Suiza Aero engine for that one. We also converted another Espana Suiza engine for a similar boat owned by George Ryder, well-known Cessnock identity. In those days, he was the owner of Rover Motors. And it was good competition, and we were the two fastest boats on the lake at that time. Speaking about them being unsafe, they were governed by a forward rudder, a sort of a fin in the front of the boat, not behind it. And it was quite easy to spin. I remember we were leading in a race in one particular time at Toronto, and this fin had broken off. And we ended up through the side of Lance Lawson's cruiser into his pantry. And another time a similar accident occurred and we went straight through Windsor Baths.
George Clay was the foundation member of the Toralba Amateur Sailing Club.
The Toralba Amateur Sailing Club.
And what did you do there?
Well, I had an official job as measurer first. I used to sail, and I had the job as the official measurer to measure all the boats to see if they complied with the specification let down. I was also president of the club for a number of years and commodore of the club for a few years till I retired.
When did the VJs come to the lake?
Oh, I think they came a little bit before we started the Toralba Club. When they started the Vaucluse dinghy, they graduated up this way, and then we started the club. It started off at Marmong Point and then shifted over Toralba, and we built our own club shed at Toralba. Oh, that was just after when I got out of the army, but 1947, I think. We had about 60, I think, altogether.
You would have seen some very early boats on the lake as a child.
Oh, yes. When I was a kid, they used to have the 16-footers, and every anniversary day, they used to put on a big regatta at Spears Point. They called the Walls End Regatta, and it was a big feature every year. They used to sail from Spears Point when the park was in full swing. And they used to have a lineup of trams down on the foreshore there. There'd be 40, 50 trams lined up down between the bottom hotel and the park. And they'd stand there all day, and they used to get dispersed the crowds very quick. Or railway picnics, miners' picnics from all over the place used to come down here to Spears Point Park.
Big day.
It was a big day. Anniversary day every year, that was the main day. Oh, they had everything there. Hooplas. You know, this penny a ball, a pick at the table, freeze, doll you knock over, and all this sort of business. They were good days, better than they are now. They haven't got anything here now.
Lynn Hurd tells how he started in the boating business.
Hiring small launches, rowboats, which we built up gradually to bigger boats, half cabins, speedboats, anything at all we could hire in the marine line we put in, because in those days the restrictions by maritime weren't as stringent as they are now. But we've also noticed that when the in those early days there were very few motor cars available, and of course the miners all used to flood down to Wanjee and Belmont and the surrounding area to for the Christmas holidays, and having no motor cars and no pub at Wanjee, they wanted to go to the various pubs. So we saw the requirement and put on a ferry. It went so well we had to put another one, another one, another one. We finished up with six. They're only about 30 to 40 feet, 45 feet was the biggest, and they were all able to be run by a coxswain driver, so only one man per boat. But of course we had to have the staff back here to maintain them, and we had to build the slipways here. We pulled the market garden out and put in slipways and a workshop and so forth. But we had, all told, we had about seven coxswains, coxswain drivers. We didn't run them continually throughout the year. It was mainly the Christmas and summer season, and through the winter we only had restricted weekend runs. On top of that, of course, we did charter work, which could come any time, same as the Wanjee Queen is doing now, except they were smaller boats.
Frank Wrightson looks back to sailing around World War I.
Well, after the First World War, I think the club started again somewhere about 1919, and the boat formations began to change. Everybody was looking for a faster boat, and there were three main builders. One was Les Steele of Spears Point, and George and Foster Fennell of Toronto, and a chap of the name of Humphreys of Belmont. And they built some very fast boats. Steele, who built the Eclipse, who was a club champion. He built later Wyvern, who was a club champion, a state champion. Fennell became Messine, became a club champion. And Humphreys, I remember the Aeneas, as they call it, was a very good boat. And some of the old skippers was like Tot Walters, Clary Ingall with Britannia, Reg Webb with Digger, Jack Broughton with Pondee, Tot Walters with Kiora, Harry Richer with Thetis. They took off the championship, state championship, was sailed here, I think it was 1925 for the first time, and the Toronto boats led, and George Fennell was the winner, but they remeasured the sails and they found out they were oversized.
Did you sail yourself?
Yes, I sailed in, with the Lark and with Peter Ash. Well, I was out in Digger once as a bailer boy. That's where I first started, and it was a rough day and the boat was full of water most of the time, so I just fagged out.
One very popular means of travel has been the ferry. With a lake the size of Lake Macquarie, a natural ground for ferries. Jack Richardson, or Fisher Jack as he was known, ran ferries on the lake for most of his adult life.
He was on the lake for all of his life while living in Australia after he came from England.
I understand he also had quite a number of ferries he built. Which were these?
The Clipper and the Lily May. And the Toronto was built by Mr. Humphreys of Swansea, built the Toronto. And I don't know who built the other two boats he owned, but he ran them for many, many years on the lake and then sold them.
The ferries he ran kept a time, as this timetable shows.
Friday nights, a trip to Swansea, and Saturday he'd return. Sunday, there were two trips to Swansea. That was on the ferry run. But the boats were hired out for parties, and oftentimes there was excursions run by different people and all over the lake. Yes, he'd also go to Spears Point for picnic days, and he'd travel around the lake, and each passenger paid sixpence for the ride.
Richardson delivered groceries around the lake, a much-needed service.
Yes, he took the parcels of food from T.C. Frith's at Boolaroo. They delivered them to the wharf at Boolaroo, and we put them on the Toronto and took them to parts round the lake as we went down to Valentine, as it is known now, and then along to sometimes Rocky Point, and then on to Swansea, and sometimes we called over to Toronto. They had delivered all, he'd take any articles down the lake for so much the day and deliver any type of produce or anything, or any parts of the lake where it was inaccessible to any, even horse and cart. Those days there were no roads into the lake.
So the lake became the highway?
The lake was the highway.
Mm.
There were no roads connecting Valentine to any other part of the place, and there were no roads connecting anywhere around the lake except Morissette and Dora Creek, and probably Swansea had a road, but there were no sharabanks or anything like that they had those days. There were nothing, no lorries or anything to convey the produce anywhere.
Jack Richardson's daughter, May Baxter, commenting.
The transport was used especially, that was number one, for bits of groceries and stuff. That was loaded at Cockle Creek, most of it was loaded at Cockle Creek Railway, and put on the Phoenix, the Rose, and Maggie Johnson.
Richardson's
launches and one thing another.
What do you remember about Richardson's launches?
Richardson? Well, he used to take it down to Nord's Wharf. He used to take all the groceries from Fritz down to Nord's Wharf once a week or once a fortnight. Walter Bergen used to go down there, and my brother-in-law used to go down and get the orders, and then they'd transfer them down to the point, so and take them round the water.
Albert Hawkins and his sister Mrs. Cope's commenting. Ernie Clack takes us back to the early pleasure steamers.
With the advent of the railway line, shipping on the lake, taking also into consideration the dangerous bar, it had deteriorated considerably. Johnson's of Wall's End, they found it more convenient and economical. They built two boats. One was the Pinafore, another, it was proved too small, and then they built what they called the Big Pinafore, steam-driven, and they towed the punts up to Miller's Wharf, Cockle Creek, up near the crossroads. They towed these boats laden with, mostly in these days now, it's getting up to, well, the biggest amount of timber handled was pit props for the mines, and although it meant unloading them at Miller's Wharf and then putting them on horse and drays or wagons and taking them to Wall's End, at least they didn't have to risk going over the bar where many boats met their fate there. And big boats were built eventually, some 70 feet, some 90 feet. They did the same with a lot of the trade to Newcastle. They carried it overland. Then with the coming of the railway, shipping was drastically cut. And then Johnson's switched over to pleasure steamers.
What were some of the big pleasure steamers on the lake at that time?
The Maggie Johnson, the Cora, the Azar came later. It was a very modern boat. I think it... I don't think it was steam. I think it was oil-driven. It came out later in the, well, into the 1900s.
And some of the pleasure craft on the lake were the Maggie Johnson, the Rose, the Phoenix, the Anne. Harry Bond looks to another ferry service.
And the first ferry service that I remember would be the one owned by Agar Brothers at Spears Point. They ran a daily service from Spears Point, calling in at Marmong, Stony Point, Valentine, of course it was called Crowder's Bay in those days, then on down the channel to Swansea, and returning around about 6 o'clock at night.
What size boats are we looking at there?
They had three cruisers. One would be about 100 feet, called the Azile. One was called the Canberra, and the other was called Palm Beach. They would be about 60 foot in length.
Lynn Hurd started his business activities in ferries.
He operated from, our base of course was always Toronto, and our main run was Toronto to Belmont, which was the other main site. Then, of course, we went from Belmont to Swansea, and Belmont to Wanjee, which was one of the biggest runs when the miners were down. And then we extended up to Spears Point, and it crisscrossed all of those in together. But the biggest run we had was Wanjee, during the Christmas holidays, was Wanjee to Belmont. We used to take over probably five or six boatloads in the morning to the pub and bring them back at night. One night, I know, they were usually pretty cooperative, but this night about 300 of them waited till the last ferry, and it could only carry 150. But they all got on, every one of them. And they said, the coxswain came back and he said, they said, if you don't want it, we will. And he said, I knew they really well would have, so I took them. During the war years, there were no ferries here. The old Wanjee Queen and all the early ferries, they were gone long ago. And there was no boats running here at all. Prior to the war, I don't know anything about the place much, except that there were ferries running from Cockle Creek, and of course, during the war, all the boats came off. So there was nothing running on the lake at all during the war years, except the raft boats. Mm-hmm. Only ones
about. Local fisherman Don Cameron recalls his father was a ferry captain.
He went to drive ferries for a short period and then he came back to fishing later on in his life.
When he was in the ferry game, how many ferries did he own and whereabouts did they go?
Well, he wasn't actually an owner, he was just a captain of the ferries. And he drove ferries from Wanjee. And they went all over the lake. They were actually their only means of transport in those days. The road system was pretty antiquated sort of thing. There was only bush tracks going all around the lake, and they used the ferries as a sort of commuter service. There was wharves all around the lake. The old wharves are still there, actually. You can see parts of the piles and that are still left there.
Well, the ones that I travelled on was called the Pioneer, and there was the Wanjee Wanjee. But I believe there was, I think there was one before that called the Wanjee Queen.
They had ferries running from Cockle Creek, and they used to call Toronto, Belmont and Swansea. They were quite big boats. And then they had just a Toronto-only ferry, which used to cater for the people going to Newcastle by train. They ran up and down along the shore every morning and every evening. And then there's another one that used to run at the weekend, mostly for fishermen. They used to go round, stop in the fishing grounds and have quite an enjoyable time.
Jack Richardson was a boat builder, bridge builder, and actually built a houseboat.
Well, Dad decided he'd build a houseboat and live on the water. So he bought a timber lighter, and of course, as the timber lighter was floating, the spirit levels and the plumb bobs were no good to straighten up the uprights or any part of the studs. So I used to stand and eye them straight along the edge of the timber lighter, and I'd get a line on that and then line the studs up for him. So between us, we lined them all up and it was pretty square when we finished. He built two boats, the Clipper and the Lily May, and they were quite good boats. We used to go fishing to Lake Macquarie and come home with about 80 to 100 tailor. We were dragging the lines behind the back of the boat and catching the fish on the lines.
Mrs. May Baxter discussing her father's building projects. Jack Richardson also ran punts.
Yes, he had three punts, a large one and two small ones, and he hired those out to people building their own jetties, and he also worked on them to build wharves and build bridges and things like that on the lake. He built many wharves on the lake. He built one at Pulber Island and one at Valentine, one at Turalba, was it Spears Point, and the bridge over the creek connecting Spears Point with the Five Islands to Turalba.
Friday and Saturdays were very busy, and to make sure he ate properly.
Fridays and Saturdays, sometimes he stayed at Swansea so as to pick up early passengers and bring them back to Spears Point. And Mum then used to cook breakfasts and dinners, and we children took them down in the tram to Spears Point and made sure that Dad had a good meal.
And your mother had a rather special heating implement made to keep meals hot.
Yes, she had a copper plate made, and the boiling water was put in the bottom of the receptacle at the bottom of the plate, and then there was a plate on top, and we covered that and wrapped it up and took it down. It was quite warm when we got to Spears Point.
One problem for men and boats is the Swansea Bar. Charlie Hollis comments.
Swansea Bar, it's got a bad name, and we've lost a couple of lives on Swansea Bar, but it's not a bar that is bad as they paint it to be. It's nothing like the bars further up north, but the big thing is people should get a little bit of local knowledge before they use the bar. And with a bit of local knowledge, almost any time you can get in. There's only one time as hard northeasters and a run out tide. You don't go near the bar, but anyone that's had any experience at all, well, they should realise that that is taboo as far as bars go anywhere along the coast.
Perhaps for someone listening to this program who doesn't really know what a bar is, could you define what a bar is?
Yes, well, the bar is the sand that's washed out from the river to the entrance with a strong run-out tide. And once it gets out into the past the entrance, it comes into the still water and it just drops off there. And you finish up creating a big shallow bank. Well, then the seas coming in from the opposite direction break on the bar like it does on the beach and creates this the breakers. And to use a bar, you generally find a narrow gutter in it somewhere, so you've got to find the gutter and come through. Swansea Bar has got what we call leads on it, or beacons, to come in on, but you still have to have local knowledge to come in because the beacons are not always in the right place. On some bars, they have the beacons on trolley lines so as they can move them back and forwards to line up whichever way the bar moves with the current and the winds.
Charles Hollis commenting in this local history program on boating and sailing on Lake Macquarie. For further information on this subject, contact your local library.